Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. For more than 30 years, Ben Matlin has been in an inter-abled relationship, where one partner lives with a disability and the other doesn't. In fact, he says he coined the phrase. And in his essay, he writes about why and how that relationship has endured. His piece is read by Peter Sarsgaard. Peter has starred in An Education and Wormwood, and his new movie is The Sound of Silence.
When Mary Lois and I started our relationship on that humid night in Stamford, Connecticut, we may not have expected it to last. After all, I was unable to scratch my own nose, let alone walk. And she was 3 years older than me and far more independent. I asked if I could kiss her. I had to ask because I couldn't lean in on my own. My body doesn't work that way. So she leaned in and kissed me as I'd never been kissed before. "You were just a kid," she told me recently. I was 19. She wore her straight auburn hair and a short boy cut then. More than 30 years later, she still does, though the color has faded. I wasn't only attracted to her iconoclastic spirit, alluring eyes, and figure. I was on a mission to lose my virginity. I was born with spinal muscular atrophy, a congenital, progressive, incurable neuromuscular condition. But my lifelong disability has never prevented me from doing anything I set my mind to. I was one of the first quadriplegic students to matriculate at Harvard, and spinal muscular atrophy wasn't going to keep me from having a girlfriend, getting married, or having a family. I now write with a voice recognition computer program. I no longer have the strength to hold or use a pencil. I drive my motorized wheelchair with a hypersensitive, lip-controlled mini joystick. Nevertheless, that first girlfriend and I have been married for nearly 3 decades. It's a relationship that, in many ways, has only become more mysterious to me as the years have passed. Early on, I took for granted the fact that I would find love. I was cocky that way. But over time, I have wondered why and how my marriage has worked out. So when I landed a contract several years ago to write about the love between people with disabilities and people without, I figured I'd start with my own marriage. And when I asked Mary Lois what she first saw in me, a wheelchair-using teenager whose condition was only going to get worse, she said, "You weren't aggressive, but you had a hunger, and that was sexy." It felt strange to be interviewing her. She is, after all, my lifelong companion and the mother of our 2 daughters, both now in college. "I knew I was safe with you," she said. "It was only going to go as far and as fast as I wanted, which was something I needed at that time." I learned to live with my disability just as the world was learning to live with people with disabilities as a political force, a civil rights movement. That no doubt helped my cause, which was simply to live a full and normal life. She'd had no experience dealing with someone like me, but she learned to live with my limitations, those caused by my atrophied muscles, my respiratory distresses, and my myriad external obstacles and attitudes. Through real-world, on-the-job training. rewinding the mental movie of our lives together, I see us on our first date a few weeks after that kiss, talking during a long evening stroll. We struggled to keep pace with each other as we moved by different means. There was an Elvis Costello concert in Manhattan. I made her walk 30 blocks through the sweltering stench of Hell's Kitchen in her date shoes and slinky pink dress because in those days, New York buses and taxis weren't wheelchair accessible, and I didn't yet have a van. And along the way, strangers harassed us with rude remarks, and we ignored them, but such comments would follow us for the rest of our lives. I believe a part of us grew stronger because of them. The novelty of our relationship became an asset, not a liability, and we thought, in our innocence, why shouldn't we throw in our lots together? Toward the end of that night, emboldened by a couple of black Russians downed at a bar on the walk back, I suggested she ride in my lap. "Your feet hurt," I said. She resisted, but like many disabled people, I had learned not to take no for an answer, although then, as before, everything relied on my powers of persuasion and my charm, or so I like to think. "Really?" I said, "Climb on, it won't hurt." Now, whether I meant it wouldn't hurt me or her, I no longer recall. Was it the sheer force of my personality, my gentle boldness, that made her not only jump on my lap, but also fall in love with me? It certainly wasn't the ease with which I moved through life. But there was another reason. A few years earlier, she had come to Stanford for the summer to look after my infant half-brother. She was still in college and was at loose ends, so by that first date, we'd already spent a lot of time living in the same house. "I think that's how you flew under my radar," she said. "Because we were able to become friends first, without any pressure." This proximity also gave her time to get used to my disability, to see how my family handled it, to demystify it. Nevertheless, even if my disability made me seem harmless, she admitted to me she was nervous during our first sexual encounters in the weeks that followed that concert, afraid, primarily, about injuring me. "You were so fragile looking," she said, "and I was worried about balancing in that tiny bed. And if there was a problem, would I have to go get your attendant or worse, your dad?" I shudder to think. None of that had ever occurred to me. "But you survived the first few encounters," she said, "and then came the miracle. When I was able to lift you." I remember it well. Several months later, on a desperate whim, she tried lifting me out of my wheelchair and discovered she could. I weighed about 120 pounds, not nothing. Yet somehow she managed it, which meant from then on, we could go almost anywhere and do anything without an attendant tagging along. Over time, she wanted to do more for me, shaving me, for instance, or clipping and cleaning my fingernails. And at first I resisted, but she did these things better than any paid person could. She had a vested interest in my grooming. For better or worse, disability tends to break down the barriers of privacy. And when someone must assist you with dressing, bathing, and using the bathroom, you come to understand each other's most intimate processes. I still have paid help every day, but she fills in the gaps. "We faced life's challenges as they arrived, survived them, even grew from them," she said. "But if I had foreseen them all at once, they would have been too terrifying." Terrifying? I want to ask her more about that. But I suppose I shouldn't be surprised. You meet problems as they arise. Besides, the important question on my mind is, what happens when those challenges become too much? "I think the same is true for many people," she said, meaning we all face challenges we didn't anticipate. Disability is just part of it, but there are so many kinds of troubles families endure. Early on, before we had children, I got deeply involved in disability rights and pride, a movement that can sometimes view able-bodied people as the enemy, as oppressors. For a while, this led me to feel more bonded with a disabled woman and fellow advocate than with my wife. Then, 10 years ago, I nearly died from complications from gastrointestinal surgery, a months-long crisis that humbled us both. I wanted to know, what would she do differently if she had to do it over again? What advice would she offer a young, able-bodied woman considering a relationship with a disabled young man? I think I was better off not knowing the challenges, she said. Perhaps just the knowledge that we're still together and best friends all these years later. To know that in advance would sustain me in those times when it didn't seem possible. True. Most couples face seemingly indomitable trials. What's different about us is that we dealt with those tests sooner, not later. We began with few illusions or unrealistic expectations, unless you consider my wanting to have sex, get married, and start a family to be unrealistic. And the truth is that once you've had your children straighten you in your wheelchair or drive it down the street when your hand gives out, your whole perception of propriety and family roles tends to get upended, which is another way of saying that my disability has been, in a strange way, liberating, allowing us to live and love as we wish.
That's Peter Sarsgaard, reading Ben Matlin's essay, How 30 Blocks Became 30 Years. We'll catch up with Ben after the break. Ben Matlin's Modern Love essay was published almost 2 years ago. When we talked to him, we asked him what Mary Lois thought of the piece he'd written.
I'm not sure she's read it. My wife's a very private person, really, and she doesn't often read what I write. She gives me permission, of course, and supports what I do, but she gets a little embarrassed by it, frankly.
Ben is 56 now, and he told us more about what it was like to grow up with spinal muscular atrophy.
It's a genetic neuromuscular condition, so I have full sensation from head to toe, but no muscles. And it is progressive, so as a baby, I crawled a little bit, but I never walked or stood at all. Always used a wheelchair, always needed help for things. But growing up, I always expected to live a normal life and to have all the things anybody else would have, including a career, including love and marriage.
Ben is an essayist and a journalist who writes about finance and investing. And he's written two books. One is about disability rights, and the other is a deep investigation of interabled romances like his own.
Interabled romances, I think, well, any romance for that matter, there are perils. There is a difference between the partners that can seem unbridgeable. Now, the unique pleasures, I think, of interabled romance are related to this sense that you put pretenses aside. I mean, you really kind of know each other, warts and all. There's an intimacy from the vulnerability, the interdependence, that breeds a closeness, I think. You can become like one unit. My disability becomes her disability, but her strengths become mine too.
Ben says that he struggled with suggesting that his relationship with Mary Lois is anything extraordinary.
We all get tired of the people who stop us in the mall and say, God, you guys, you're... inspire me, you're my heroes, you're beautiful. Yeah, shut up, we're just another couple. Treat us like anybody else. But on the other hand, maybe we are something special. I mean, we're not in it to inspire other people, thank you very much. But maybe we faced things, had to face things that may seem scary, but you can get through them. And once you do, you feel closer.
And Mary Lois and Ben have had to face difficulties, such as health scares, almost 5 years spent trying to get pregnant, and judgment from the people around them.
You know, the waiter in the restaurant who assumed that she's ordered for me, or said so, what would he have? The worst, when she was pregnant with our second daughter, oh, I had a bad bronchitis. I was hospitalized. One of the nurses pulled her aside and said, he's not really the father, right? People say these things. People can't believe, you know, that we're a couple, that we have sex, that we have children. People have assumed she's my nurse or my sister or sometimes my mother. And it can be upsetting, it can make you angry, but it can also, it's you and me against the world. We're not an exemplary couple by any means, we're just a couple and we have our problems, Lord knows, but perhaps our example, and all the other ones out there on the internet and out in the world, can show people the possibilities are maybe more, bigger, more interesting, more diverse than people had realized not so long ago.
Ben Matlin, he lives in Los Angeles. His latest book is In Sickness and in Health, Love, Disability, and a Quest to Understand the Perils and Pleasures of Interabled Romance. More after the break. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
One thing I love about this column when it works well is it's always love in practice. It's always, it's not your idealized love. It's not a fantasy. It's here are two people with all of their individual problems and assets and all of that, but what do they work out together? You know, how do they work together and how do they make it work against all odds? And he just does such a lovely job of that.
And here's Peter Sarsgaard.
The thing that interested me most in this piece is that moment where she says, if I had known what was to come, I'm not sure I would have done it. Or that notion that, like, the way that we wind up in relationships and end up in long relationships with people is we just take one step at a time. Anything can happen at any moment. We all could be disabled tomorrow. You know, it's, I think that the idea that some of us are disabled and others aren't is a fallacy, because in the end, we are all lying horizontal and need help. And I really was drawn to that idea, I guess.
Thanks to Peter for reading this week's essay. You can see him in the new movie, The Sound of Silence. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music courtesy of APM. If you love the podcast, rate or review us on Apple Podcasts, or better yet, tell your friends to listen. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.